Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to the Football Writers Podcast. My name is Mike Calvin. I'm joined by Daniel Storey, the author and columnist, and by Seb Stafford-Blore, editor of Tifo Football. Summer of love? Hardly. It's been pantomime season at Newcastle. They've allowed an inspirational manager to walk away. They've sold their top goalscorer. They've sold their fans down the river again. It looks like Steve Bruce may be making the biggest mistake of a long career. Now, I know it's a crowded field, Dan, but is there a more dysfunctional club?
Not in the Premier League, I don't think. There are clubs further down on the brink possibly of extinction, but this isn't a competition and there's enough shame and guilt to go round and Newcastle deserve all they get. I think the best way to describe it now is that there is a Newcastle United FC and there's a Mike Ashley FC. And the last embers of Newcastle United FC probably went with Rafa Benitez because he was the only one keeping that house of cards upright. And supporters were always going to mutiny and were always going to protest if Benitez went. They promised that and Benitez has gone and they will do that. And I don't think any of the answers the club have from this moment in, other than a takeover that's gone very quiet, are going to give them acceptable answers. And I completely agree with them on that.
Mm. We're talking about the 19th richest club in the world. Mm-hmm. They look like that they're being cheap and nasty. You've got what looks like an unsavoury situation developing almost as we speak. You know, it's understood that Steve Bruce has resigned along with his assistants Steve Agnew and Stephen Clements from Sheffield Wednesday. So we'll hear more about that as the week progresses, I'm sure. It's an unholy mess, isn't it?
It really is. And my instinct when I heard about the Steve Bruce connection, Mike, was that it just seems like Mike actually quite enjoys the provocation of it. Obviously, Steve Bruce being I know he's a Geordie, but he's a former Sunderland manager, and it will not be a popular appointment. Taking out all the sort of the issue with his managerial record and the whether he deserves that promotion or not. But I think it's just dispiriting. It's like the last bit of air being taken out of the balloon, because while Benitez was there, it was almost like a sort of there was a sense of willful denial about the fan base. They knew the reality of their situation. They knew the limitations of it, but Benitez is a football manager and he is about the football. He does not fit the trend of managers who had been appointed before him and obviously after him either. So it's I just feel very sorry for Newcastle supporters because it's a they've had to endure this for a really, really long time, and this is just it's just another insult, actually.
Mm. Do you think this is a tipping point that there will be? You know, we're hearing about people not renewing season tickets. Can we gather a half-empty St James's Park come the season starting?
I think that probably is the way to force change, but it's not as simple as that. Newcastle and the North East is an area that lives for its football. It lives for Saturday 3 p.m. And there's an argument that some fans will say, and I completely understand it, that Mike Ashley has taken all the joy out of it. The last final defeat would be for us to not go at all. Because that's their club, as they see it. This is our club and you will not defeat me. And if I don't go anymore, you will have defeated me. It's not as easy as not renewing season tickets. If you don't renew your season ticket at Newcastle, you lose all your away points. And away tickets are hard to come by. So if a takeover then goes through and they want to go to games again and there's a change of ethos, a change of ownership, then they might want to go again and it's not as easy. So I can understand them not, but I also think that's probably... Well, I think it's their best hope of change. I also think there are very, very few more stubborn football club owners than Mike Ashley. And nothing we've seen so far indicates a willingness to change on anything other than his terms. Maybe it would work if there was no one at St James's Park. But a football club gains its revenue far less out of ticket sales than it used to. So there's no guarantee it does. And it might just make things worse for those supporters. Because, as I say, the one thing they've got at the moment is that they go to games. And they still, maybe out of some warped enjoyment, but it's still theirs. If they stop going, then they've got nothing.
Mm. And the fans are asking, you know, where's the money gone?
Mm. Yeah, there's a regular... misaccusation against supporters in this type of situation, that they are asking for the world, that they are asking for glory and trophies. They don't want that at Newcastle. What they want is they want a club that they can like as well as love, they can believe in, and B, they want a club that is at least willing to fulfil its potential, at least facing in the right direction to fulfil its potential. If it fulfils its potential, Seb's right, they can finish in the top six. There's no reason why not. But they're not asking for that at the moment. All they're asking is a belief that the club is trying to do that. And that's what they're finding impossible to believe. Because at every step of the way, the club seem and its owner seems intent on tripping it up, intent on holding it back. And that is incredibly dispiriting. It's incredibly damning of an owner that... It takes some effort to make Newcastle as bad as it is. It takes some effort to make that club as... miserable as it is, and he's managed it.
And commercially as unsuccessful as it is as well. The growth figures for Newcastle over the last... Because that's always been presented as a trade-off, Mike. It's a... We recede our footballing ambition for the sake of this this other quality which is never actually described or detailed properly. And yet, when you look at the figures over the last, I think, 15 years, I think Newcastle have grown their commercial revenue by about £1 million a year.
It may be...
In this era, that's...
Yeah, it's mad.
That's
made me laugh because... When they sold Ayoze Perez to Leicester for £30 million, the line from the club was that this will go into the transfer budget.
And I thought,
well, that's good, though. It means it will join the Moussa Sissoko money and the Andy Carroll money.
Yeah, and the Johan Gabay money.
Money and the Gabay money. They're not asking to spend £100 million. They're asking to spend money that the club, off its own back, generates.
Yeah,
push that back into the club and into the region and see what can happen.
Yeah, that begs the question, Seb. Are they going to be left with a relegation squad?
Absolutely. At the moment, Mike, they've got no centre-forward. I mean, they've got Dwight Gale returning from West Brom and there are, I'm sure, academy prospects that could potentially fill the role. But in my mind, Salomon Rondon was the premier target man in the division last season. He's left because Mike Ashley doesn't want to sanction a deal for a player of that age. OK, that's a perspective of sorts. But then you have to actually put something in his place. So at the moment, if they finish any higher than 20th, I'll be very surprised. They've got no manager, no centre-forward. There's been no improvement whatsoever. They have lost a very valuable source of goals with nothing in its place. So I can't even spin a positive, even if I'm being contrary.
Mm. If you're a Sheffield Wednesday supporter, you're entitled to feel completely betrayed, aren't you?
Yeah, I think you probably are. Football has a pretty skewed concept of loyalty anyway, in that if none of this interest had happened and Sheffield Wednesday had lost their first 8 games of the season, then the club would have quickly got rid of Steve Bruce. But even outside of that hypothetical, they can feel a little bit aggrieved. You know, they put some faith and patience in Steve Bruce when they appointed him because he felt he needed a break. He felt he needed a step away from the game for personal reasons as well as professional. But they understood that and, you know, they gave him that. I think he's only managed 18 games and he's won 7 of them, and there were signs that things were turning around. But Sheffield Wednesday is a club that needs stability at the moment. Financially, they are in a precarious situation, as many Championship clubs are. They've only just released their accounts for the 17-18 season and they only look acceptable because they've sold the club has sold the stadium effectively to a third party that generated enough money to avoid losses, heavy losses. So they're in a precarious situation, and the one thing they needed was stability, and that's what Bruce promised them when he took over. Mm. So, yeah, I think they can feel pretty betrayed, but that's the reality of life, unfortunately. If I can't really blame Steve Bruce for wanting to manage his hometown club. I can question his judgment in wanting to manage this Newcastle United, because it's not the Newcastle United that he's got in his mind. It's not the one he's got in his heart. It's a very different club to that.
Mm. He will also come in as a symbol of a regime that is loathed
Yeah, he will. And it's been very interesting to hear former Newcastle players. I saw Michael Chopra, who was not particularly successful as a player there, but come out and say, hang on a minute, this is not good enough. This is not good enough for supporters. If you're a man of that city, back the supporters, don't back the club. And they have someone like Bruce who will come in and think, I can change this. But that's wishful thinking. I understand he wants another shot at the Premier League. I understand he feels like he wants to manage Newcastle, but this is not Newcastle anymore. It's Mike Ashley FC, and they're very different things.
It's very strange to hear him say, when he talked about Newcastle owed the respect of the conversation when he was still on the contract from Sheffield Wednesday, it's like he's talking about John Hall's club rather than Mike Ashley. They aren't owed any respect in that situation. It was a terrible PR gaffe straight off the bat. Mm. If you want to come into the club, it's your hometown club. I understand that. But if you're not going into that situation with your eyes open and a full appreciation for what that situation is, that is not a particularly good sign.
It just sells you. Unfortunately, it sells you to supporters as a yes man for the regime. Yep. So it sells it as you're either putting yourself first or you're putting the club in its current entity first, and neither of those are appetising to supporters.
I hesitate to say this because it might come across as being cynical, but what direct influence can a supporters group or a group of supporters have? This morning we've also seen a group of influencers at Arsenal launching a We Care Do You campaign aimed at Stan Kroenke, who is a veteran of basically outraging fan bases in North America.
Yep. Yeah.
Very, very worthy stuff, but will it actually matter?
I think the mattering is hard to define. And in terms of financial impact, it's never meant less. We might have those banners of without supporters, football is nothing. But in financial terms, that's simply not true. Without supporters, financially, football is a tiny little bit less. Not enough less. But it's about feeling like you're trying to make a difference. It's about feeling that if in 5 years' time the club is in ruins, can you feel that you did all you could for something you love very deeply? For something that you've possibly and probably loved more than anything and for longer than anything else in your life. So it is about feeling as if you're making a difference, and it's about channeling your energies into something that is at least positive. So I get it. I get why people do that. Whether it makes a difference or not, I don't know, but there's probably a sense of, well, if nothing else, at least we've given it an effort. But to repeat what I said before, some people will feel that boycotts and there's a difference between protest and boycott. Protest is making a point on something. Boycott is actively avoiding going to something that you have loved doing for a long time. And that's a lot to ask. And the difficulty of this, and the reason that owners like Stan Kroenke win, is that things like this cause disconnect and fractions between supporter groups and between supporter bases. That's what's happening at Newcastle United at the moment. And that's a huge shame, because the one thing they need to be is, to pardon the pun, is united on these sort of things. And they're not at the moment.
If we look at Arsenal, are we watching the sort of breakdown of any sort of collective culture, team ethic, if you like? You've got Laurent Koscielny, essentially going on strike.
Yeah.
He's saying he's promised one thing, the club are saying something completely different. It's at a time where the club is in complete flux, simply because of the ownership issues that we've talked about. Where do Arsenal go from this? If they're not strong, the whole stronger together movement, if they're not together, they are in real deep trouble.
Absolutely, Mike. I think the Koscielny incident was interesting because he's probably the last player I'd have expected to behave like that. He's been a model professional. He doesn't create any noise. There's never been any audible disaffection throughout his career. So his strike action, his absent without leave moment, it seems like a symptom of a perfect storm of circumstance at the club. So you have a very disappointing end of the season. You have the historic issues with the ownership and the lack of investment and the strangely low transfer budget. I'd say there is the mismanagement of the wage budget within that, which has caused problems. The Aaron Ramsey decision, which has this kind of strange binary relationship with the retention of Mesut Ozil. But I think the greatest affliction for Arsenal now is that sort of there's no real reason to buy in. And I'd extend that to supporters and prospective players. Where are Arsenal going? What is this club's direction and trajectory? You think if you were a player with a Champions League past and you had a transfer offer on the table for Arsenal, what is your motivation to join that club? Because what are you thinking? Where are you? What are you attaching your wagons to? Like, am I going to be playing in the Champions League in a couple of years? Am I going to be surrounded by world-class players? Probably not on both accounts. It's a very difficult time for them because their identity, their historic identity is unimpeachable, fine, but their modern identity, what they stand for in the pure footballing sense, I have no idea, which is a, you know, say what you like about Arsene Wenger, everyone had a position within that argument, but you knew what Arsenal were, you knew what they were trying to do. Now, I don't know. Now, I mean, Edu has returned as sporting director, that's potentially good news, theoretically. But they seem to be in this a very new type of limbo. And that must be very, very difficult for anyone with any emotional ties to the club.
Yeah. Because of Emery's five captains, two have gone, one's gone AWOL. You've then got Xhaka, who's been mediocre in patches, let's say. And you've got Ozil, who's a completely polarising figure. How can you get any sort of substance out of that?
No, you can't. But it's very similar to Manchester United in that I'm slightly loath to blame existing players at a club where, from top down, everything has been allowed to rot. You know, if you don't fix the roof, then don't complain when the carpets in the lounge are mouldy and wet. And that's what's happened to the squad. It's been allowed to go mouldy. It's been allowed to rot. And, yes, it would be nice if players could seize the initiative and could grab games and seasons and their fellow teammates by the scruff of the neck. And Arsenal had those players in Tony Adams and Patrick Vieira. And there's a sense of what has been lost in that initiative, that sense of initiative. But some players aren't naturally like that. And unfortunately, what happens is that when you let something rot from the top down, it becomes very, very hard to fix those problems without fixing the problems at the top, because all you're doing is, to crowbar in another analogy, is you're rearranging decks on the Titanic. And that's what's happening at Manchester United. That's what's happening at Arsenal. And there doesn't seem to be, yes, Edu coming in is positive, but there doesn't seem to be a real sense of proactively trying to fix those things. Everything seems like reaction, just make do reaction every summer rather than going, let's just go back to basics here and completely revamp it. I thought Unai Emery was a good appointment. In hindsight, I think they would have been better going for a Mikel Arteta, because it would have at least engineered perhaps some sort of reset, and they desperately need that reset.
You know what's very discouraging, Mike, is that sort of the beginning of the summer, like, you know, even fans who just watched the occasional game on TV could have diagnose the footballing issues at Arsenal. Can't defend, weak in central midfield, a little bit lighter, definitely left-sided fullback. The injury to Hector Bellerin suggested they need cover in that position too. And we are 3 weeks away from the Community Shield, and so far, Arsenal's problems, their reaction to them has been to try and sign Wilfried Zaha and a Brazilian forward. It's as if, you know, you can tolerate your football club making mistakes because transfer dealing is a toss of the coin, we know this. But it seems at the moment like people don't really understand what the problems are. And that's very discouraging. If there's no targeted remedy, then what do you think? It's as if, like, one of the talking heads from a fan channel is in charge of transfer policy now. Be like, I want the shiny thing. I want the shiny thing to distract me from all the things that are actually wrong. Mm-hmm. That's not how you run a successful football club.
Because I'm hearing on a whole number of levels that Arsenal are incredibly ham-fisted in their transfer negotiations, and it seems that we're going through that with Tierney at Celtic as well, where they made, you know, they lowballed very early on, and now they've eventually come up with the 25 million that Celtic say they want, and Celtic just saying, well, what have you done for us lately? Give us some more.
It's that combination of incompetence and kind of hardwired inbuilt arrogance from when they were effectively a super club, and they're not a super club anymore, because everyone has, at the time when they were a super club, everyone has that much money now. You know, Crystal Palace have that much money now. They don't need to sell a player. They don't need to get spooked by Arsenal anymore. You know, the only way that you are able to lowball clubs nowadays is if you persuade a player or an agent to really push it. And Arsenal aren't attractive enough to persuade club agents and players to do that anymore. So you have to do what Aston Villa have done this summer, which is you overpay for a player because that's how you get business done efficiently. Otherwise, you're left with 2 weeks in a transfer window remaining and you haven't signed anyone because you can't persuade players to come over the line. It's that mix of arrogance and incompetence is incredibly damaging, and it enables clubs as big as Arsenal and as big as Manchester United to effectively fall into the pack.
Yeah, now I'm going to square a ball across an empty six-yard box for you here. Is the Arsenal situation highlighted by the fact that Tottenham are no longer Spursy. They're serious.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's fair. I mean, it's not a very flattering comparison, isn't it? Is it? Because you sort of, I think back to, you know, the sort of the projections of what Tottenham's summer was likely to be at the beginning of last season, when you have the financial burden of the stadium, the difficulties of essentially being in transit, being, you know, living out of a hotel room figuratively for most of the season. Arsenal have a desperate need in central midfield. Tottenham, despite the difficulties with the stadium and the cost of it, are able to go out and spend £70 million on probably, I'd say, the best central midfielder on the market in Europe this summer. How is that possible? Like, how is... I understand Champions League revenue, but in terms of kind of what the club have been dealing with, how are Arsenal not, at the very least, after this long history of sustained Champions League qualification, how has the mismanagement been so severe that they have lost not only positional ground, in the football sense, to Spurs, but also financial parity? It's extraordinary. And, I'm not partisan enough to take pleasure in that, because it's just... It's too modern footbally to be a tribal victory. It's just, it's depressing. It's kind of, this is, you know, the Arsenal fans were sold an illusion. You know, the new stadium was supposed to bring sort of this rich new era. And apart from kind of a few sort of defective players that have been brought in at huge cost who have performed to a high level, it feels like that deal's been reneged on now. And if you're an Arsenal fan, you've just got to hate watching Tottenham qualify for European Cup final, qualifying for the Champions League again, and signing the player that they are. It's got to be very, very difficult.
And if Spurs steal William Saliba from Saint-Étienne, yeah, that'll put the tin lid on it, won't it?
Yeah, it's a symbolic transfer. It really is.
I feel Daniel Levy might be being a little bit mischievous.
But it is.
It's unlike him.
But I think, it comes back to that hardwired arrogance of just assuming that your deal's done so you can let it organically sort itself out without making sure you're getting it over the line. Yeah. The two clubs that are suffering from that the most, Manchester United and Arsenal, are the two that, when they were inefficient, were saved by consistent managers. They were saved by Alex Ferguson, they were saved by Arsene Wenger for a period of time. When Liverpool, when Manchester City, when Tottenham got things wrong, they were fully punished for it because they didn't have any cover for that. And I think those two managers have provided so much cover over the last 15, 20 years that now they're not there and they're making mistakes, those clubs are being scared and they're finally being punished for those inefficiencies. Whereas the clubs who were punished previously, the Liverpools, the Manchester Cities, the Tottenhams, yes, with an extraordinary amount of money, but they are able to prove that they've learned from those mistakes and to now do things properly.
Mm. Talking about Manchester United, it's been a bit of a topsy-turvy weekend. You know, on Saturday, it was assumed that they'd done a deal, £80 million for Harry Maguire. Now, on Sunday, everyone rode back from that, and it seems that Maguire is, you know, he wants to go, but he's not going to become, you know, a hostage to fortune, and he'll just let the cards fall as they may. Where are Manchester United in terms of their recruitment policy? Because it seems all over the place.
Absolutely nowhere, Mike. They, we began last season talking about who they were going to appoint as the director of football, and 12 months have gone by. You know, maybe a dozen different people have been connected, and yet there is still no obvious renovation of the footballing department. So at the moment you have a manager who, I know he's under a permanent contract now, but is still viewed really as an interim. You have a few changes. Mike Phelan has been installed in a position that is still a little bit ill-defined at the moment, I think that's fair to say. And so without that kind of that overarching structure being implemented, there is no direction. We do not know what Manchester United are trying to achieve. We understand that they have a defensive weakness and that they would quite like to sign Harry Maguire for £80 million, which is extraordinary. But even with that, you have a very good player in Harry Maguire, but if you go further south, you can have Toby Alderweireld for £25 million in three different instalments over 2 years. So that's quite hard for me to rationalise. I know there's a homegrown player emphasis now, that's fine. But United don't seem to be building towards anything. It goes, we've covered this two or three times now. It's like you can tolerate downturns because football is cyclical and always has been and always will be. What you can't tolerate during your downturns is the idea that no route has been planned back up. And that's Manchester United. It's a Dan mentioned arrogance earlier. I think it's a really fair way of putting it. It's a, we're Manchester United, and you hear this from Solskjaer. You hear this from Solskjaer, when he's talking about not selling players, or we're Manchester United this. It's just not relevant anymore. In reality, Manchester United are a Europa League team, and they deserve to be, because they're not good enough to play in the Champions League now. So once that's recognised, and once the ailments which instruct that are cured, then you have a reason to believe that Manchester United are resurgent, as it is. They're just, every year, it gets a bit more muddled. And every year, you see less and less appetite for, not revolution, but a renovation. And it's just, it's a mess.
Because we're almost in a sort of parallel situation in terms of local rivalry with Manchester City, where you've got a clear strategy. Mm-hmm. You know, they recognise that Fernandinho is on his last leg, so they brought in Rodri. Mm. Within that, there was some talk about them being linked with Dani Alves. In what universe does that make sense? Great player, by the way.
Yes, and I think a 35-year-old Dani Alves is probably a 31, 32-year-old version of any other world-class fullback. But no, it doesn't make much sense, purely because he is a name signing nowadays. As soon as you move to Paris Saint-Germain, quite frankly, you become a name signing. And Pep Guardiola doesn't seem to want to go down that route, and I completely understand it. I think he's got enough ego, in a complimentary sense, enough ego in that team to take it on already without bringing in others. Rodri is a perfect example of Manchester City. They identify the player. He first comes on the radar of transfer rumours 18 months ago, and 18 months down the line, they get their man. And this is a club that tried to replicate and cherry-pick everything Barcelona did, because Barcelona were doing everything better than anyone else. And they're reaping the rewards for that. And they are looking constantly proactively. Even when they're winning, they are doing more pro-action than Manchester United are when they're losing. And that's pretty damning.
Mm. Let's look at Liverpool, Seb. There's a lot of talk on the strength of one pre-season friendly at Tranmere of Rian Brewster having an important role to play this season. Is that just pre-season whimsy?
He scored yesterday at Bradford too. hard to say. I mean, I don't feel like I've got a hold on what kind of player Rian Brewster is. Really impressive young man. Like, to hear him speak and to hear him speak about the challenges he's faced in his career and the difficulties he's experienced with racial abuse on the field and from the stands, I have a lot of admiration for him. As a footballer, I don't know, because I don't know where he fits in. I mean, where are you placing him to give him significant game time within that front three, because he's a forward? Not quite sure what kind of forward.
Younger,
he is.
Upgraded version of Sturridge, maybe?
Maybe, but then even, you know, the actual version of Sturridge was before he left Liverpool, kind of incidental. Divock Origi has just signed a new contract. He has, in a strange way, proven his worth over the last sort of few weeks of last season. I don't know. It's one of those things that people say. I mean, Pep Guardiola did the same with Phil Foden. Like, it's he's definitely my plans, and he's definitely going to be inserted into important, pertinent situations. And that was kind of true by the end of the season, but over the year as a whole, not really. So I don't know. I think I'd quite like to see him go on loan somewhere, just to see him discover himself as a player and to actually define a role for himself. And then maybe in a year's time, come back and fight for whatever that role actually is. That'd be maybe the best situation for him.
What do Liverpool need, Dan, to actually stay at the same level or even reach a higher level?
I think Klopp's next challenge is to keep Liverpool as a super club in terms of achievement, which they have now reached by definition, while also trying to maintain those links with the community, with young players, with players like Rian Brewster, and you know, it was Ben Woodburn before him, and
Harry Wilson, I guess.
Exactly, Harry Wilson's there, and Trent Alexander-Arnold is a you know, a flashing neon light towards that, but he only came into the team because Nathaniel Clyne was injured and he took his chance unbelievably. Joe Gomez is a young player, but obviously they signed him from Charlton. So I think that's his next challenge, is to, rather than signing players to bolster his squad, to see if he can bring players through to be the challengers for the starting positions, because they've got an incredibly young team. You know, Jordan Henderson was their oldest, most regular player last season. James Milner came in and out, but Henderson's still only, he's not 30 yet. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot more to come out of Naby Keita. There's a lot more to come out of Fabinho. Oxlade-Chamberlain will be fully fit. Joe Gomez was injured for parts of last season. So there's a heck of a lot of competition for places in that squad before you bring in the young player. So I think that's his challenge. And because he knows if he can do that, without resorting to romantic cliche, it can be very powerful at Liverpool. If you can, if you can create a conveyor belt of youngsters when the club is successful, I mean, that's the best that Liverpool have done in their history, is by doing that. So I think that's his challenge. And I mean, they're very fortunate in that they are comprehensive second favourites for the Premier League. They will be very disappointed if they don't finish in the top two in the Premier League next season, because purely because of the leaps and bounds they came last season. So he's kind of got a little window, because if Liverpool don't win the league next season and they don't win the Champions League next season, I think Klopp still retains a heck of a lot of goodwill. I don't think anyone sees that as horrible disappointment, simply because of what he did last season.
Let's look at Everton across the city and the influence of a director of football. Marcel Brands, in this case, looks like Fabian Delph is going in for around about 8 million, which strikes me as very good business. Yeah. Talk about Diego Costa, which is basically you're throwing a grenade into the dressing room if it happens. How is that experiment at Everton working, do you think?
At the moment, positively. I mean, there's a caveat here in that Everton have are operating under a transfer ban for under 18 players. I think that expires in 2020. And one of Marcel Brands' selling points was his ability to make the most of academy products. So let's park that for another year. But I think finally at Everton, you've got a little bit of a sense of order. I think prior to him arriving, it was very, very difficult to understand their movement in the transfer window. It was like, you know, the seasons under Steve Walsh were... it was like what we said about Manchester United. They were trying to cure a problem without really understanding what it was. So you just got a lot of players being bought for a lot of money to fill no specific place in the team, which is very, very strange. Mm-hmm. But I think that there's obviously a little bit of a partnership between Brands and Marco Silva. That's very, very important, that dynamic between manager and director of football. You've got to have a singular philosophy between them. Farhad Moshiri, I think, is behind the Diego Costa thing. That's the name that gets attached to him, which is strange because the best owners are the ones that have no dealings whatsoever in football because they're not qualified. Like, rich, successful men think they know sport because they watch a lot of it. But these positions in the modern day are filled by people with actual qualifications and experience. And Everton have that. I mean, Walsh was a scout, not really a director of football. Brands has a track record for making clubs, not teams necessarily, but clubs better and healthier and more productive and more financially efficient. And there are those signs. It's been nicely quiet. They've got Andre Gomez in. There are a few rumours floating around. But there is there's a nice balance. Delph is a logical signing. So everything that's happening at Everton, quite differently to a few years ago, as a neutral, you look at it and say, yeah, that makes sense. They need a centre-forward. Mm. They don't need a Diego Costa-shaped centre-forward, but they need a centre-forward. But otherwise, they've kind of moved quite nicely through the summer. And I think that is always a symptom of health, when you can understand what they're trying to achieve.
Mm. Similarly, at Norwich, you've got another director of football who has a very, very clear vision of what that club represents, and he's changed the culture of the club. Yep. You know, I'm talking about Stu Webber there. How do you think they'll get on this season, Norwich?
I think it's harder and harder for promoted clubs to stay up, to make their mark. And it feels more and more like they have two choices, which is either to spend big because they feel they need to, and that's correct.
I don't think they're going to do
that. No, which is correct, or stick to exactly what they know. And they've got this vision, and they'd be stupid to do anything else. Whether that's enough to keep them up is another matter entirely. It sounds a very negative way of looking at it, but I think promoted clubs now are coming up and thinking, right, let me look at the league table and pick three clubs I think we can finish above. And I'm sure that's deep down is what most Norwich fans are looking at the table and doing. But if it doesn't work and if they do go down again, there's no reason why they can't be stronger for the experience, certainly financially, but also with the fact they've stuck to their guns, the fact that they are doing things the right way, the fact that they're buying players that fit a pattern and fit a mould of the club. As long as Daniel Farke is there, I don't see any reason to change that. Why would they? Their promotion last season was, and the manner in which they achieved it was truly extraordinary. It really was.
Mm. Oh, you can see Farke's fingerprints over their transfer dealings so far. You know, you've got Ralph Farman, the goalkeeper they brought in from Schalke, the Swiss striker Dermich.
Yeah.
It was a pretty much left field guy, but you know they got him from Mönchengladbach. There is signs, you know, you talked earlier on, Seb, about you need an umbilical cord between the manager and the director of football. They have got that.
Yeah, you know, what a career Stuart Webber's had, actually. Like, I mean, I think the guy was, he was head of youth at Wrexham when he was 19 or something, and he's younger than I am now. And he's been at Liverpool, he's been at Wolves. He was one of the powers behind Huddersfield's rise. I know he was instrumental in the signing of Aaron Moy there, which Huddersfield wouldn't...
They brought in Wagner, didn't they?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, so what a career. So at this point, why would you not have faith in his ability to adapt to Premier League? I don't really like Dermich. I found that a little bit strange.
That was a weird one.
The goalkeeper, I don't know. I know that there are some issues with Tim Krul, that there's a little bit of chatter amongst the fans about whether he's good enough for the Premier League. So fine, fair enough. But I'm interested by Norwich. I think they've come to the Premier League with a very different sort of mindset. They've come playing stylish football, of course, but with a different scouting imperative, which is fascinating. Mm.
You mentioned Villa earlier on, and you know, there is this sort of... It's almost a knee-jerk debate at the moment. Are they going to do a Fulham? Yep. It looks like they're going to spend around about the same money, about 100 million.
Yep.
Are they going about it in a better fashion?
I think they're going about it in the only fashion they could, for several reasons. Very quickly, firstly, they lost 14 players at the end of last season, some of those who were loan deals ending, which left them, I think, with 17 players in the first team squad. So they had a lot of work to do anyway. They've also bought defenders, which Fulham didn't do, really. Not good ones. They had too much faith in Dennis Adoy and Tim Ream for most of the season, which was to their downfall. Yeah. And they've also bought their players early, which always sticks out because they've done more business than most. But Fulham signed 5 players on deadline day last summer. That was the problem. You created that air of transience that it felt like no one was mucking into a potential relegation battle, and no one ever did really muck into it. Dean Smith is a Villa man through and through, and he's a man who demands players buy into that ethos of the club. So by buying them early, that's exactly what you'll persuade them to do. Mm. I still think it's going to be very hard for them to stay up, but I don't think you can criticise them for doing what they've done, because I don't actually think they had a choice.
Well, you know, one of the things people miss with Fulham, like, buying a lot of players is not necessarily a symptom of dysfunction. Dan said it, Fulham needs to do it. Fulham's recruiting problems lasted for 3 years. They pre-existed their promotion. They had... I forget his first name, but the Klein, the... Tony Khan's friend, brought in his date. Yeah. He's the guy attached to that sumo wrestling outfit anecdote that is one of the best I've ever heard, actually, in football. But you had this disconnect between what the manager wanted, between who he wanted to manage, and the type of player the club wanted to bring in. It is always a disaster. Villa don't have that. No. If you listen to Christian Perslow talk about Villa now, it is always a we. It is always with reference to Dean Smith. It is always what we as a club are trying to do. And that is, there's no reason as a result to prejudge what's happening this summer.
There's no Andreas Schürrle signing there. There's no signing that you look at and go, really want to be, you're only here because you didn't have another offer.
Yeah.
They've made none of those signings. Yeah.
And it helps also that Dean has come from club Brentford, who are extremely smart in recruitment.
Absolutely, yeah. You know,
he wanted Bjorn Engels, who he's just got... a year ago when he was at Brentford.
Yeah, and he signs Ezri Konsa, who's been one of the, or is one of the highest rated centre backs in the country, and one of the Championship's best defenders. So, yeah, we've said it over and over on this show already, but there is pro action there. There is a plan. This is carrying out a plan early in the transfer window. This isn't a mad rush of signings or a mad panic. This is merely carrying out what they wanted to achieve. And yes, they have overpaid for players. I think they've overpaid for Tyrone Mings. I think they've overpaid for Matt Target, but that's the price you pay now when you want to get things done quickly, and the club that's selling those players doesn't need to sell them. So you either hang on and buy them on the last day for an inflated fee, or you buy them for an inflated fee early on. And yeah. I think that's the best way to do it.
Mm. What do you think of the way that Sheffield United are going about things? Oh, Chris Wilder signed a new longer-term contract. Phil Jagielka's going back there, which has, you know, sentimental attachment. But if we're being, you know, pretty forensic about it, he was on the slide, wasn't he, at Everton? Mm. Is it enough that that football club will be built in the image of its manager?
Well, I think Chris Wilder is a very innovative manager. I mean, I particularly like when the
set pieces are fantastic.
His set pieces, it's amazing how often last season Sheffield United scored a goal from a set piece when a principal goal threat was completely unmarked. It just suggests incredibly good set piece design. I think Premier League audiences will enjoy watching the way his centre backs play with the overlap around the outside. I think they'll enjoy watching Oliver Norwood and his sort of delivery from that shallow right position. I've got a little bit of a question mark against Billy Sharp and David McGoldrick. I don't know. I'd love Billy Sharp to sort of have an Andy Johnson season. Just, you know, a proper Indian summer, and McGoldrick has strangely become very prolific in his 30s. I don't know whether they'll score enough goals, but they're not tactically blunt. This is not, with the greatest respect to Neil Warnock, this is not Cardiff City again. This is a slightly underpowered team, but a very smart and tactically well-designed team. So they'll outthink some people and they'll surprise them. They're not a blood and thunder charge into tackles, win every 50-50 team. That's the misconception. And that's just because they're a team solely comprised of British and Irish players and managed by someone who cut his teeth in the non-leagues. But they are, they'll be interesting. They'll be good to watch.
Mm. Any other breakout teams? You know, I'm looking at Wolves.
Mm.
And here again, we talk about the corporatisation of football, don't we? You know, they're in Shanghai today. There's a pop-up Wolves mega store, which has been stormed by the media and newfound fans in China. But is the club in danger of losing something intrinsic, something really important?
Possibly. It's obviously last week they lost Laurie Dalrymple, who was, very much a businessman, but was a kind of halfway house between Wolves and Fosun. You know, he kept both a foot in both camps, I think it's fair to say, and that will be a very hard role and a hard person to replace. But I think that represents the fact that Wolves' journey now is almost being self-propelled by the success on the pitch. So that there's clearly the relationship with Jorge Mendes. There's no doubt about that. But that seems to be very safe. The ownership now seems to be settled. So I think they think that the only way is up. The question with Wolves will always happen when things slow down, whether there is any inbuilt patience in this rise. And personally, I think I would favour Leicester as the breakout team over Wolves this season, because I think there is a slightly ironically, on the back of winning the most astonishing league title in history, but there is a sense that it doesn't all have to happen at once. And if there are a couple of months of slowdown, that it doesn't build any pressure on anyone. They, to me, feel more sustainable at the moment. But if you look where Wolves have come from, it's pretty hard to have a pop at anyone involved in the whole process, because it's been astonishing.
Mm. What about West Ham?
Worrying noises. This forward thing just feels very reminiscent of where they were a couple of years ago.
Well, they've had 38 since 2010.
so, like, in the last couple of weeks, they've missed out on Maxi Gomez, who refused to even speak to them before going to Valencia. They want to spend £40 million on Sebastian Haller, Eintracht Frankfurt. Good player, but very much played in Luka Jovic's shadow last season. This morning on the train up to record this, Mike, I heard that they're interested in Andrea Belotti, the Torino forward, which you just think, you're dreaming, no chance. Mm. And it just feels like...
They were linked with Higuain as well, weren't they?
But, Mike, if you take those four players as a group, they're not the same forward.
It's a funny boy band, isn't it?
But
they're not a natural fit, are they?
You know, where's the harmony in that group? Like, it's kind of, we want a forward and we want to spend a lot of money on a forward and we don't really care how he fits into the team, because you've got four very different players. So where is your... I'm kind of at a loss. It just feels so West Ham.
I actually think they'd be better off getting one and playing their band of exciting attacking midfielders as one big melting pot. I mean, you've got Felipe Anderson and you've got Andrei Yarmolenko and you've got Fornals that's come in and you've got Mikel Antonio that still does his thing and you've got Manuel Lanzini back
fit again. Yeah.
You've got a really exciting group of attacking midfielders there that you're almost holding back, I think, by playing a centre forward. Just play a group of them and be exciting.
Who's coming out with these names? Like, who is saying, right, we've got a list of targets, I'm going to work our way through them. Ordinarily, at normally every other club, that list of targets is kind of the same player. Yeah, with some exceptions or with some strengths and weaknesses. But you think, right, we've got a first and a second and a third. And West Ham is just a kind of, we've got this big cheque for £40 million and we are determined to spend it on someone. That is not, I have trouble with that.
Well, it's owners and cookie jars, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's just like someone's going, oh, you know, I saw this guy on TV or this YouTube, but, you know, like, it's like the players that we've heard of that we can afford and that, you know, will bring some attention. It's just like, that is not how you build a football team. Yeah. Maybe how you sell some shirts, but, yeah.
Let's end, if we may, with some reflections on a forward who knew his own role and everyone knew his role, Peter Crouch, his retirement. We've lost the character, that's for sure. What else have we lost?
I think he probably is, and it's a very sweeping generalisation, but I think he's probably everyone's second favourite footballer. Your favourite footballer is the best player at your club, generally, and your second favourite footballer is Peter Crouch. He was better than he looked, and he was better than most of us gave him credit for. But yet he is someone who absolutely squeezed everything out of what he had, particularly international level, and managed to do something that we increasingly think is a very serious business with a smile on his face. Absolutely didn't take himself too seriously. And, well, I've got a lot of time for that because we do take football very, very seriously, too seriously. It's a lot easier to do it with a smile on your face when you're earning a lot of money, but, yeah many didn't. So, yeah, good on him. Yeah.
He's attached to one of my favourite footballing moments, his goal at the Etihad as a Tottenham fan. So, wonderful. But I think he's self-deprecating. How rare is that? Like a guy that just doesn't... He knew how to poke fun at himself. He knew how lucky he was to play the game for a living. I mean, remember the first time I ever saw him was a QPR against Sheffield Wednesday in probably about 2001. He was absolutely dreadful. You know, but he was a young guy and he was still sort of learning how to use his body properly. And then within 10 years, he's playing in the Champions League, he's playing at World Cups. And like, what a good role model in the footballing sense. You know, the amount of, if you sort of read up in the other parts of the career, the amount of disdain he suffered through because of his shape and his height. And he was a pretty slender, pretty thin guy.
Bambi on ice.
Yeah, like that's, it's only really just changing now. But in the academy world where they kind of wanted cookie cutter athletes to play in a very specific way, that was difficult, presumably, for him. So all the respect in the world for what he achieved. Yeah.
Well, football is full of whispers and moans, but I've never heard anyone with a bad word to say about Peter Crouch. That says it all. Thanks for joining us here on the Football Writers Podcast.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.